Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 3rd of December. Our guest this hour says in his new book, iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alterations of the Modern Mind, that the current explosion of digital technology not only is changing the way we live and communicate, but it is rapidly and profoundly altering our brains. Daily exposure to high technology, computers, smartphones, video games, search engines like Google and Yahoo are stimulating brain cell alteration and neurotransmitter release, gradually strengthening new neural pathways in our brains while weakening old ones. This isn't all good news. We're having some problems with our social skills as a result of being so wired. So the book offers ideas for how to learn to relate to human beings one-on-one in a social situation rather than just online. And it's looks very much in depth at how our brains are changing. Dr. Gary Small is our guest. He is director of the Memory and Aging Research Center and the Center on Aging at UCLA. His research team is supported by the National Institutes on Health as well as many major national foundations. In addition to his work on brain science, he has over 20 years of extensive clinical experience in treating young adult, middle-aged, and older individuals as a practicing psychiatrist. And he has also developed, co-invented actually, brain imaging technology that for the first time in history can measure the physical evidence of Alzheimer's disease and brain aging in living human beings. We're going to welcome phone calls for Dr. Small. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us by email, which I guess you would if you're listening to this show, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Dr. Small. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I was reading the early parts of your book last night and thought, well, I got to check on my son and see how his homework is doing, and went upstairs, and there he was texting, talking on the telephone, listening to music from the computer, and doing geography all at the same time. I went, how can you do this?
It's a challenging time for those of us who are digital immigrants, and we've got digital natives, these teenagers who are multitasking with ease.
Oh, are they ever. And it's very rapid fire, particularly the text messaging. Have you noticed that? It's just bam, 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 and you're text messaging almost 11 people, one after another, after another, after another.
And they're really good at it.
Yes.
Very effective in getting the information across, and it has an emotional impact.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, as you say, it's not all good, it's not all bad, but what we're trying to do with iBrain is to get people to pay attention to it, because the technology is not just changing our lives, it's changing our brains.
Right. You just brought up digital natives and digital immigrants. What do you mean by that? What's the difference?
It's the idea that we have a young generation today that is immersed in this technology from a very early age. So they're literally brought up with their brains exposed to the technology. The average young person spends about 8.5 to 9 hours a day with the technology.
Whoa.
So their brains are developing and learning to use it very effectively, but there's a loss, and that is the face-to-face human contact time. And
mm-hmm.
the brain wiring system that controls that is not as well developed compared to the digital immigrants, the older generation, that comes to this technology more reluctantly later in life. And so what we have is, instead of a generation gap, a brain gap
mm-hmm.
that create this digital divide, and we need a solution. The solution I see is upgrading the tech skills of the older generation and helping younger people with their face-to-face human contact skills.
Hmm. So we can help each other.
We can.
Hey!
There's hope for us.
So I would imagine that you've become pretty adept at some of these technologies as a result of doing all that you've done. Was it hard for you?
Yeah, I am a card-carrying digital immigrant. I will admit it. And I got one of the first combination Palm Pilot cell phones, and I hung on to that as long as I could until it finally died. So I don't adapt to the new technologies, the innovations, as readily as a younger person, but I really enjoy it. I have a lot of technology around me. I spend a lot of time with it, and that's typical of many of today's digital immigrants, that they are struggling with the same kinds of techno-brain burnout and technology overload challenges as the younger generation.
Mm-hmm. You talk about early in the book this person who has everything, you know, all the phone numbers, all the plans for the week, and all kinds of information on, I don't know, on a cell phone or Palm Pilot or BlackBerry. That's sure where I am. A BlackBerry, and is looking at somebody who's writing everything down in a book, and they're on a bus or somewhere, and then all of a sudden they get off the bus, and the guy drops his BlackBerry, and everything is scattered all over, and the woman walks away with everything neatly written in her book. Who's better off?
Well, you know, I think that probably ultimately the person who's better off is the person who can master both the technology skills and the social skills, because that's what I see in the future. I mean, our face-to-face human contact skills have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, and we're really good at it. I mean, we need to know when the best email response is, let's talk, because many of these complex, subtle issues cannot be resolved in these email strings or text messages. We have to sit down, look at each other face to face, and very quickly we can get to the crux of the matter.
Right. Sit down and look at each other. There's a good idea. What is this phrase you used? Was it techno-brain burnout?
I've had it. You've had it. Admit it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we have.
Well, you know, it's the technology is so seductive. It's addictive, and we spend hours with our email. We could get up from our seat and walk across the room or to the next office and talk to someone, but we get lazy. We're sitting there, we'll just send another email note, and it goes on and on. And after a while, rather than being focused, there's sort of a brain fog. We're exhausted. You may have some neck pain or backache. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of symptoms many digital immigrants and digital natives are complaining of. So we have to pace ourselves, know when to take breaks, to try to balance the technology time with the offline time.
How much information can the brain take in terms, well, a couple questions here, just in terms of information, no matter where you get it, and secondly, how many sources before you're just fried?
Well, brains are remarkably plastic and malleable, and we can train them to take in more and more information. Certainly there is a point where you get fried, but what we tend to adapt to is a different type of information processing, kind of a staccato rhythm to it, and we get into a state of partial continuous attention, where we're always scanning the environment for that next text message, phone call, email message that may be important. But that can be a state of heightened stress for the brain. And we know that when we're under stress, our body will secrete stress hormones like cortisol that can literally shrink the hippocampal memory centers of the brain. So we've got to really take note of it and not overdo it.
You talk also about how rapidly the brains are changing, and tell me about this in some detail. The significant changes in the brain are happening over mere decades rather than over millennia. What's going on?
Well, we know that the brain is sensitive to stimuli from moment to moment. So when you read a book page or look at a computer screen, there is a constellation of complex neurochemical reactions going on in your brain in response to that stimulation. Another basic principle is that when we repeat a stimulus, the neural circuits that control the response will, in a sense, strengthen. They'll develop shortcuts and become more efficient. What also happens is that if we neglect other kinds of mental activities, the neural circuits that control those, particularly the face-to-face social contact experiences, those tend to weaken. So we're having a change or alteration of brain circuitry because of the immersion in the technology. Now, as far as permanent change and brain evolution, that, of course, takes generational changes to occur. So that gets into the principles of natural selection that Darwin described. And what I argue in iBrain is that the next generation that will perform better, that is most likely to excel, will be that generation that adapts best to the technology.
Mm-hmm. And will it change, could it even change our physical appearance? Somewhere years ago, maybe it was even you who said this, I remember seeing this picture of how human beings might evolve, that their heads will become much bigger. They won't find much of a need to go out in nature and run anymore. They're going to be at their computers, at their desks, and so their bodies will change significantly.
Well, they'll also have big thumbs for the text messaging, right? So I think we can speculate what it will look like. I mean, some people might argue that the heads will be smaller, that our brains will be more efficient. Or even I talk about the future brain in the last chapter of iBrain about brain technology interface developments, where even today volunteers can get hooked up to electrodes on their foreheads that allows them to control a computer cursor. So it may be possible to communicate wirelessly to each other just through our thoughts. So it sounds like science fiction, but it's really in the realm of science in the very near future.
And has such wonderful implications for people who are not able to use their bodies, who have disabilities, right?
Yeah, and a lot of this brain-computer interface technology has been developed to help people with Parkinson's, stroke disease, different types of brain disorders. But it may also be used to facilitate our communication with each other and with machines.
What's happening to our brains in terms of the ability to concentrate? You use this phrase, continuous partial attention, which seems to me is the only thing that can be going on if you've got so much coming into your brain at the same time.
Yeah, I think we learn different patterns of thinking. There is a tendency to sacrifice depth for breadth. So in other words, you can go online and get any kind of information you want through search engines, but how much do we delve into concepts and think about them when we can just skirt off to the next idea? And you know, I've seen it happen to myself where my wife will have a question. I'll say, well, let me look it up online, and I get distracted. I see one website, and the next thing I know, 20 minutes have gone,
right,
and I'm
right.
Searching something else. So there's this superficiality in terms of the way we think that raises concerns for many people. I think with the young digital natives, that they're not learning delayed gratification because they know they can get that information very quickly anytime. They don't have to get out of their seat and go to the library and look things up. And I think it really changes how we perceive the world and how we perceive ourselves.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. One line is open if you'd like to join our conversation. Dr. Gary Small is our guest. His book is iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. 800-486-8655 is the number, or send an email if you'd like, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now for Dr. Gary Small, starting with Tina from Shorewood. Hi, Tina.
Good morning, and thank you for a wonderful program. I have a question. I've always been wondering about this, and I hope Dr. Small can answer or at least help. I had studied something. To the best of my knowledge, biologically, we do not hear with our ears or see with our eyes in digital, but more in analog. And so we have all this technology, and I have heard years ago about that's why it's easier to listen to vinyl records than CDs. One gets what's called CD burnout, where you just can't take the sound of a CD anymore.
Huh.
But the sound of an album is more pleasant.
Really?
I don't know, but this is what I've read. So I would like to know, I don't think that we perceive in digital.
Well, you know, it's an interesting comment. I'm not sure of the scientific evidence supporting that point of view. It probably is controversial, and one could even argue that there is a digital component to how our brains work because there's digital is basically based on this concept of an on-off communication system. So either you get a packet of a positive response or a negative response or no response. And in the brain, that's how our neurons communicate, through little neurotransmitter packets. And either the message gets across or it doesn't. So it has this on-off phenomenon, as opposed to analog, which is a continuous kind of a message. Now, it may be that people are feeling that they like the analog information better because it has an emotional appeal to it. Certainly those of us who are digital immigrants grew up in an analog world where we had LPs, long playing records, 33 and a third albums that we enjoyed and have a lot of fond memories about.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. And yet it wasn't very long before those pleasing sounds became scratchy or unusable because of the fact they were analog.
And you're right, Kathleen. That really points to the wonderful innovations of technology, that now we can keep those fond memories around for much longer, and they don't get all scratchy and blurred. Many digital immigrants are now baby boomers, and so they're finding their memory skills are not as good as they used to be, and they want to preserve them as best as they can.
Right. So what have you done with all of those old albums?
What have I done?
I don't know what to do with my old albums. They're all in the basement, and I know some people are making popcorn dishes out of them.
they're stored somewhere. I saw in one of the newspapers recently that someone was going back to their LPs and really enjoying it. It really is a different time. And it's nice to think about those times.
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Tina, for the call. Michael is next from Danbury. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good. And it's a very interesting discussion. My concern is, and it is a concern, and to your guest, I'd like him to comment, is that very often what we do is we do these studies and so forth, and we think everybody on the planet's with us and so on. And so my concern is, and where I'd like to have your comment, is that 94% of the world's population are in undeveloped countries and are not available to any of this technology. And we're really only talking about 6% of the people who may be influenced by this effect. So I'm kind of wondering, are we kind of going to end up with this kind of Orwellian thing where, you know, there's a small group of people who have all this, evolutionary change, but the rest of them are going to be these barbarians out there? I'm just wondering, mm-hmm. and all these people are coming our way, too. So, what do you think about that?
Well, these are big questions. I don't think we have answers to them. We can certainly speculate, and that it may come to that there's now, I'm talking in terms of a brain gap dividing generations in the developed world. But what will happen? What kind of gap will we have? Will there be a global technology gap where less developed countries are just do not have the technology available? Now, having said that, there is a surprising amount of penetration of the technologies in less developed areas, and you can see even in some countries around the world where you don't have the wealth that you have in the United States or Europe or other developed countries, you still see the internet cafes, and there's the penetration of the cell phones, which is quite interesting. And the other aspect about the World Wide Web and cell phones is that it does tend to make the world smaller, that we can reach out to people across the globe very quickly and be able to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm. I may make another comment?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, it's kind of like this situation that we have in the religious world, if you will. We've got a lot of ancient religions out there that behave very much like their forefathers and so forth, whereas in the industrialized world, the religious community has moved in a much different direction, and there's a tremendous dislocation and insensitivity between them. And that's really kind of maybe a better analogy of what I'm looking at, is that we're going to have these young people who emerge into the adult world managing the globe and be very insensitive to the larger majority who is not along with us, even though the world is getting much smaller.
Well, you know, these are big issues, big questions, and I don't think we're going to answer them today. But one thing that's quite interesting, despite the brain gap, we do know that even older brains are malleable and adapt to the technology. At UCLA, we recently completed a study entitled Your Brain on Google, and we saw for the first time what the brain looked like, an older brain looked like, when it searched online. And what we found was that with training, an older brain very quickly can fire up those neural circuits that are quite active in a common internet search task.
Thank you so much for your call. Excuse me. We go next to Robert from Culver, Minnesota. Hello, Robert.
Hi.
Excuse me.
You got there.
Yeah, no, I did say I got some cough.
Hey, Kathleen, I hope that's a real cough and not a virtual cough.
Oh, yes. No. I've got a granddaughter, great-granddaughter, that is jumping on the telephone, calling me, and are you on the computer now? No. And so on and so forth. In other words, she is leaning towards the automated world of electronics. And I said, did you do your writing? Oh, I forgot about that. Do your writing first before you get on the computer. Folks, this little girl is 2.5 years old.
Whoa.
And I'll tell you, parents out there, believe me, teach your children to read and write and do arithmetic before you even give them a bloody computer. Really, I mean, now, after that, then, they can go to the computer and talk to the rest of the world. But, boy, I'll tell you, it scares me, and I don't know about you, and I'm going to get your book there, Doctor.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Does it scare you, Dr. Small?
Yeah, sometimes it scares me. Sometimes it excites me. I think it's an interesting comment from this gentleman. You know, first, I was thrilled. I thought, oh, this is great. This is an example of bridging the brain gap. But when I heard how young she was, it kind of got me a little bit scared. Hmm. I was speaking at one of the West Los Angeles schools to the parent group, and we had a group of the high schoolers who voluntarily went through a day without technology to see what it would be like, and they wrote essays about it, and they had a panel discussion, and it was quite interesting. I mean, many of them talked about their parents and teachers complaining, how can you do your homework with all this technology, and some even admitted that they get confused. Are they doing their homework, or are they going on Facebook? And it's a real challenging time, I think, for parents, grandparents, and educators.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Robert, very much for your call. We have some lines open if you want to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. Let's talk a little bit more about the problem areas, because I found it very striking, Dr. Small, that you have sections in your book on exercises that we can do so we learn how to reconnect face-to-face.
I'm trying to get at this challenge and problem I see with the younger generation. And many will comment how they notice that there's less eye contact, they're not as adept at holding a conversation. Since iBrain went to press, there was a more recent study that found that when young people play a video game, their ability to recognize the emotional expression of a face was diminished. So we do have some evidence showing that there is an interference with these kinds of skills as a result of too much technology. And, you know, psychologists and behaviorists have developed ways to help people communicate better in very simple kinds of exercises, learning to use eye contact to recognize nonverbal cues. And interestingly, these kinds of skills ultimately could be taught with computer programs. And there are some computer programs that help people improve their face-to-face human contact skills.
And you talk about the ramifications of this. What are you going to do about secretaries of state or people who are in service work in other countries and all kinds of jobs where you have to read somebody's facial expression?
There could be a huge problems as a result of it. If our politicians, our leaders, cannot communicate face-to-face, how is that going to affect diplomacy and other worldwide issues that we have to address? So I think these are big issues. I think we need to attack them head on.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Joe from Viroqua. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering what you thought about it seems like I've noticed a change in the young people, their common sense, because they don't want to memorize or take in, they don't have to memorize as much because they know that the information, they can usually look it up right then. And then when they go to solve a problem on the spot, they just have a lot of problems. They seem to kind of freeze up because they don't have anything to help them with that on the spot unless they're tied into something that's just information they're pulling off the web.
It's an interesting observation, and you know, there is this tendency to use the technology in a way that makes us less thoughtful and in a sense brain lazy, because you know, why should I bother to write something from scratch if I can just go in and reorder the words in my word processor, or I can just look it up online very quickly and I don't have to think about it. And there's actually some neuroscience that supports this observation. We know that the young brain, which is most exposed to the technology, is still developing. In fact, an adolescent brain has not developed the frontal lobe skills of a middle-aged brain. Now, the front part of the brain controls complex reasoning, judgment, trying to put together the big picture. And what will be the effect of this 9 hours a day of technology exposure on that development of the frontal lobe? Now, I can tell you, I have observed this in my own life. I have a teenage daughter who I recently taught to drive, and it struck me that a teenage brain is not quite ready to drive, anticipating what's going to happen with the next move of the car in front of you. So I think that may be a part of what's going on here.
Oh, that's interesting. So are you leading a movement for getting a driver's license at 21?
I'm not doing that, but I got to tell you, I think in 6 months, my hair went from jet black to kind of a grayish color.
Oh, it is hard to teach someone to drive, isn't it? Yes, it's a big thing to do, right? And now after what you've said, maybe my teenager won't drive for a long time. Yeah.
Well, I think they can do it. I think we can do it. We just have to compensate for it. And, you know, another area that's important in brain development, we know that empathy skills are not quite developed in a teenager. If you do systematic studies of empathy in an adolescent, you find it takes them longer to perceive the other person's emotional point of view. So it takes some learning to do that. And again, will we have a future generation that cannot put together the big picture and lacks the empathy of prior generations?
Hmm. Thanks, Joe, so much for your call. Let's go to Mike from Oshkosh next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a kind of an off-the-wall comment to possibly stir up a little debate, and that is I would ask your guest if he still has his slide rule and knows how to use it.
You know, I was thinking about my slide rule when somebody talked about that earlier, because the question about, you know, are our brains going to get lazy? I thought about that because we use slide rules as an aid during tests. We could actually have them there during the chemistry tests or the math tests and science tests. But it required some thoughtfulness to put together the solution to the problem. My slide rule, to answer you directly, I'm sure it's tucked away somewhere with my LP records, and I haven't used it in years. And I would think that quickly I could remember how to use it. Right now, it would probably be hard for me to figure it out, but it would take me a few moments.
I have one more comment, if I may. I was on the very cutting edge in 1972 in taking quantitative analysis chemistry. It was the last thing I needed to complete. And the professor allowed us to have and use our new calculator.
Yes.
I paid $150 for a calculator that you could buy for $10 today.
Huh.
And the other thing is you can take your vinyl and put it onto CDs if you're so inclined. Okay?
They're pretty scratchy, though.
So here's someone who has mastered both the analog and the digital world. Congratulations.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest on the Ideas Network this hour is Dr. Gary Small. He's the author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. And we go next to, thanks for the call, we go to Curtis from Madison next. Hi, Curtis.
Hey, good afternoon. Or good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Anyway, I just wanted to second everything that I'm hearing on the air this morning. I've got four children, and we have deliberately kept them from media, and especially from computers. They go to a Waldorf school, and one of the, not tenants, but the statement that Waldorf subscribes to is that reduce the amount of media to children until at least past eighth grade. And I'm a director in a consulting company, a technology company, and I frequently am seeing individuals who come in who do not have the social skills to interact with clients that we might have, highly technical achieved, but do not have the social skills. And I'm seeing it with my children that we compliment all the time how socially aware and how well they look at people in the eye and they can converse. And then my sister-in-law, who has four children as well, and their children, and this is not a criticism, their children were hooked up to media from quite early on, and they literally do not know how to interact with their grandpa and grandma. And it is quite evident that the technology, at least, you know, our observance of it, does impact young children's ability to interact with individuals. And so I just wanted to not so much put something else out there, but support the topic that I was hearing this morning on the air.
Okay. Dr. Small?
Well, thank you for your comment. And I hadn't heard of this school system that restricts the media exposure up until age eight. It's interesting because the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no video and TV for children under age two because of concerns about attention deficit disorder that has been found to be associated with the media use. It's controversial because some pediatricians and other experts will say it's not the actual exposure, it's the amount of exposure. It's the content. Is it balanced with other kinds of experiences? And, you know, what we found in our study on internet searching in the older brain and was that there seems to be increased activation with internet searching. So when there's a new experience, a novel mental experience, whether it's from technology or from social interactions, there's going to be increased neural activity. But with repetition, we tend to see decreased activity, which we interpret as neural efficiency. So in a sense, our brains develop shortcuts and get more efficient at processing the information. So, you know, I think it's the observations are consistent with what many scientists and parents and grandparents are observing. And we want to keep it in mind.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. The other thing I was thinking about, and I know that you and I tried some of these last night. I was just doing one of them as we were talking, actually. The exercises that we may need to do, it sounds like a simple thing. And yet if you're using some of this technology so young in life, you need to be careful about your hands and carpal tunnel syndrome and tendonitis, because I've got a bad case of that right now. And it's directly related to typing everything, first on a typewriter.
So we're having these physical changes, mm-hmm. not just brain changes, as a result of the technology use. And there was a recent report about how it's affecting our physical health, that young people in particular are spending less time outdoors exercising. So it's there's weight gain, other weight-related and illnesses that are associated with the technology use. So, you know, one thing we know is there's always been technology innovation, but what's different today is the pace of the innovation. It's so rapid. In my generation, a big breakthrough was color television or push-button telephones, and we saw these innovations come about every few years or so. Today, it's almost weekly or monthly that we're seeing something new, and we're not considering how it's affecting both our brain and physical health.
Right. And our pocketbooks, because these are expensive pieces of equipment that become obsolete in a matter of a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brent is next. Hi, Brent from McGonigal. Hi, Brent.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine. You?
Good. Good.
Good.
I'm calling to address the comment by a caller, well, maybe about 10 or 12 minutes ago, who was a gal referencing ear fatigue and ear burnout that she had read about in regards to CDs versus LPs.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a real issue. It does happen. Whether we listen to an LP or we listen to a CD or an MP3 file, it doesn't matter. We're still perceiving the final result in an analog manner, because it's a speaker or a headphone, and that speaker or headphone is converting the information through the airwaves. So that is analog, and our ear is perceiving it in the only way that it can. But the CD technology has quite a ways to go. My background is in audio. I've been in audio for 30 years, audio engineering, and we've been dealing with this for years. CD technology has quite a few years to go to catch up to the quality and accurate representation that an LP offers. And the reason that is because in each CD player or each MP3 player, there's a small computer, a microprocessor, and memory. And the memory and the microprocessor are too small and too slow to reproduce the incredible amount of high-frequency samples, which is how the system works.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, I'll just make this quick, what they do is all sorts of synthesis and gadgetry to the signal in the high end to make up for the loss in quality, and what it does is it distorts the high frequencies and it puts overemphasis on it, and our ears detect that.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of things going on in the high end that our ears don't want to hear. And our ears are trying to filter it out. And so there's a lot of fatigue mm-hmm. that our ears are going through to do that. So.
All right, Dr. Small.
Well, I'm not an audio expert, but you've inspired me to go up in the attic and dust off my LPs and give them another try.
Yeah, I guess so. Thanks so much for the call. We need to pause for a moment. We'll return our guest, This hour is Dr. Gary Small, Director of the Memory and Aging Research Center and the Center on Aging at UCLA. He is author of iBrain, just released, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind, which includes key strategies for bridging the brain gap, a technology toolkit for digital immigrants, and tips for managing techno-brain burnout. 800-486-8655, or if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. That's talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now, and Joe from Wausau is our next caller. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I would like to kind of throw a little wrench in this whole discussion. We've been talking a lot about how technology is making people less capable of socializing with people. And how I see it is, well, I've been involved in the Internet world since, like, the fifth grade. I've taken technology and computer courses all my life into college. And I've also been in the Boy Scouts and in the natural world. And how I see it is the way we socialize is changing. I'm very active in World of Warcraft, which is a mass multiplayer online universe. And I guess the question I have is... The next generation of MMOs, or mass multiplayer online games, is coming out with technology that allows the avatars or the characters to have facial expressions and show emotion, and the storyline is bringing a very human content into it.
Huh.
And they're programming the avatars to react to their environment in a realistic, physical way, and to allow you to change the environment around you. And in a sense... immerse yourself in a completely different universe, but that reflects realistic human tendencies. So I guess, yeah, right now the Internet is very computer, and you don't really see a lot of emotion. But I see within the next 10 years we're going to be playing games and doing things on the Internet that really reflect human emotion and really begin to insert what we're lacking in technology right now.
Oh, and that's
interesting. I wanted to get your comments on that.
Yeah, Dr. Small.
Well, this is a fascinating comment. Thank you for bringing it to us. And it actually reminds me of something I said to my son not long ago, my 14-year-old son. I shouted to him, "Harry, get off that video game and come down and watch television with me." And it reflected my concern that he was spending too much time,
right,
repeated time, with the video game. And I wanted to have more of an interactive experience with him watching a television show. But in reality, you know, he plays these kinds of video games as well. And he has a headphone, and there's a social network involved in it. So it's quite true that we're using the technology in a way that is altering the way we socialize. Facebook and MySpace and now other kinds of social networking sites are bringing us together very efficiently thanks to the technology. What will the future be? I don't know. I mean, some speculate. You know, we know that literary reading is on the decline. Some think that that's because we're spending so much time with the technology. I mean, certainly, if you look at journalism, we know Christian Science Monitor now is completely paperless. Other news outlets are going more towards the Internet, away from the paper, because of the expense. In the future, we may not have novels. We may have elaborate interactive video games. People may complain that it's just too passive to try to put our own mind into that of an imaginary character. We want to be part of that through the video game.
Can you imagine that? Now, there's a world I just can't imagine. That's all I have is books. I got books. Books, books.
Well, that
books.
May change. You know,
right.
It's hard. It is hard for us to conceive of it, but
right.
It's a possibility.
Mm. Wes is next from Madison. Hi, Wes.
Hi.
Hi.
I had an observation that I wanted to share, which really wasn't my observation. I read it in an essay by David Foster Wallace on the effect of television on American fiction. But the observation was that the proliferation of our information technology is largely unidirectional. there's a sender and a receiver, whether it's radio or television or the internet or even texting now. There is an impersonal sender and receiver, and this allows us the opportunity to sort of decline the stress of having to respond to the emotion presented by another human being, which is basically a stressful thing to anyone to have to respond to the emotion of others. And what we're finding in our society is an increasing acceptance of just this ability to decline the anxiety of interacting with people. And if you have any comments on that, I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's an important distinction of today's technology communication methods and face-to-face methods, that if you're having a conversation with someone, you can respond from moment to moment. I mean, if I'm talking and I notice that you seem bored, I might pick up the pace of my conversation, or I might pepper it with a joke or an anecdote. It's harder to do that, or you can't do that with email or text messaging. It's, there's this delay in response. Now, that helps us with some of the social anxieties many people experience. Studies have found that people who are shyer tend to use email more and will try to avoid face-to-face communication. You know, I think that there is an advantage to learning these face-to-face skills, even if it makes us uncomfortable. It allows us to be more effective in many situations in communicating.
Oh, sure. Here's an email from Nate in Madison. My instant message program supports video conferencing. 10 minutes of video conferencing with someone far away is more socially satisfying than an hour of talking on the phone or a whole day of texting. I think the technology that lets you see the person's face instantly over a long distance will negate some of the negative effects of instant messaging and texting trends.
Great point. You know, I think what we're talking about today and what's emerging with this conversation is the gap we're seeing between social, direct social contact and technology contact in part is artificial. It reflects the primitive quality of the social communication online. And we can change it so that it's more effective. I've started using a program called Skype that you can download for free on the internet that allows you to have these video conferences. And my wife Gigi and I, we were in Asia recently, and it was great doing video conferences with our kids.
Huh.
It felt very immediate and saved us a lot of money with long-distance phone calls.
What's it called?
Skype, S-K-Y-P-E.
S-K-Y-P-E. Somebody is certain to call about that. Thanks, and let's go to Bill from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I want to be a Luddite here, in a sense, and I'm calling you on a cell phone, but when I really should be doing my work. Goldberg, a couple observations. John Kenneth Goldberg wrote a book called Innocent Deception, in which he said, we don't really have choice in the market. Our choices are framed for us by engineers and marketers, and we decide that, oh, that's a good deal, we'll take it. We don't really, in certain cases, we put things out of the market. But the Times says today, bidders balance gain versus cost of latest drugs. There's a tremendous cost, I think, to these kind of choices about more and more interaction in the internet, and it's sold to us in 100 different ways. But when you have emotion and feeling right around you, why don't you attend to that? Why do you have to justify consuming more electronics? And it's not just a question of consumption. It's a question, I think, of interest groups pushing agendas. And I'm not totally paranoid on this, although you may think so. But, for example, I worked in New Guinea a long time, and the United Nations and the League of Nations, well, in reverse order, pushed for their independence and development and whatever. And the people themselves say now, well, we kind of got along. We fought a lot. We had some diseases. We didn't live very long. But now we have AIDS. We don't have enough land. We all need money. We have HIV, rather. And there's increasing population, all brought around by kind of noble ideas of applying science. The Green Revolution is another case of sticking better seeds for corn and wheat and rice in places like India that actually undermine what is a very, kind of interwoven, complex kind of system of where people can depend on many different varieties of crops and not have to worry about one.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Small.
Well, these are, you know, you bring up a lot of issues of how politics and economics and marketing come into play with these new technologies. But I think, you know, the bottom line is that the technology train is way out of the station. It's charging down the tracks, and people are jumping on one way or another. And I think it's important to keep these issues in mind. Think about how the technology is not only affecting our lives, but how it's affecting our brains, what we can do about it to improve our quality of life.
Mm-hmm. And we're out of time. What a great hour this was. Great calls, too. Dr. Small, thank you. And I must comment, you have such a great voice. It's clear. I don't know if anybody's told you that, but it's very clear and intelligent.
Oh,
and,
thank you.
Yeah, it's
very kind.
It's good. Thank you. Thanks for being with us.
I enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
Dr. Gary Small, director of the Memory and Aging Research Center and the Center on Aging at UCLA. His book is iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production and for all of your, as always, great calls. Thanks, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.